I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Can the very thing that plagues a city also be the solution to its problems? Stephen Johnson may have that answer. He's the author of the new book, The Ghost Map, that details the mystery of the Broad Street cholera outbreak in London in September of 1854. Stephen also writes the Urban Planet blog for the New York Times, where he explores the most interesting questions about cities. Stephen Johnson is our guest today on Smart City. Also with us is Jackie Grimshaw. Jackie heads transportation policy and community development activities for Chicago's Center for Neighborhood Technology. That's on Smart City today, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Stephen Johnson is the author of the new book, The Ghost Map. He wrote two national bestsellers, Everything Bad is Good for You, and Mind Wide Open, Your Brain and the Neuroscience of Everyday Life. Stephen writes for Wired, Discover, and the New York Times Magazine, and he's a distinguished writer in residence at New York University's Department of Journalism. His new blog for the New York Times Select is called Urban Planet, and his new web venture is Outside.in. Stephen, your most recent book is Ghost Map. The reviews have been great, as they should be. In it, you tell the story of the Broad Street cholera outbreak that took place in London in September of 1854. What was it about that particular event that you found interesting enough to make you want to write a book about it?
Well, it's one of those stories that lies at, in a sense, the intersection point of a number of different themes. It's a kind of a classic story of public health, and it's kind of a disease detective story. Somebody described it to me as a kind of Victorian episode of CSI. and it also, because it has this map that is central to the story, a map of the outbreak that was kind of crucial in explaining how the outbreak had come about, it has a kind of information design component to it. But what I was really drawn to was the opportunity to tell the story both along those lines, but also really in a way that has not been told in the past, which is as a story of urbanism, as a story very much about a neighborhood in history and a city wrestling with a whole host of problems that many cities in the world are still wrestling with. And so I really wanted to kind of tell it in a sense with London as, you know, one of the central characters.
You said that a whole host of cities are still grappling with the problem. Are you talking about the problem of clean water?
Yeah, and some of the other ones. I mean, the most profound one is this question of clean water supplies and appropriate kind of waste removal systems, which in a sense the Victorians were having to invent on the fly. I mean, what's so amazing about this period is that, you know, you have London there, which is a city of 2.5 million people, and it's both the largest city in the world and the largest city the world has ever seen. They're in a sense, they were in the middle of this extraordinary kind of collective project of trying to figure out how you live humanely in a city of that scale and how you live safely in a city of that scale. And at that particular point in the kind of mid-1850s, they were on some level doing a terrible job of it. I mean, it was just an incredibly physically offensive place to be. You know, the smells and the, you know, kind of human filth that were everywhere and the diseases that were coming from that. The contamination of the water and all these other things just was – it was a very deadly and, you know, kind of repulsive place to be alive. So they had to, in a sense, you know, kind of solve these problems and build a set of institutions that kind of deal with them. And those of us who now enjoy large-scale metropolitan living in the developed world without worrying, say, about cholera and the water supply, are in a real way living kind of with the legacy of those, you know, amazing kind of epic decisions that the Victorians made 150 years ago. Those of us in the developing world, on the other hand, are going through the exact same crises, only that what they're trying to deal with is you know, a metropolitan space of 25 million people instead of 2.5 million people.
Do you think there are comparable problems to be solved in the developed world? You talk about the unpleasantness of the city. I mean, haven't we recreated for ourselves some of those same problems? Not of the same nature, but again, in terms of the appeal of the lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different, but I think that there are there's a kind of a comparable intelligence that we need to apply to these things. I mean, what the Victorians had was a situation where there was this large kind of unplanned evolving superorganism of the city that was literally kind of drowning in its own filth. And they were forced to say, okay, listen, we have to, you know, we have to figure out how to deal with these problems. And that may involve building sewer systems, and it may involve recognizing that kind of water supply is clean water is a crucial thing to a healthy city and all these things. In our environment, you know, when we deal with issues like, say, sprawl, we have to recognize in a kind of comparable way that, you know, there are connections between kind of individual actions kind of at the very local, hyper-local level and broader problems facing the entire planet. You know, there is a real connection between, say, suburbanization, the automobile-centric lifestyle, and, you know, the kind of global problems of climate change and, you know, renewable energy and so all those other kinds of questions. And so the Victorians, one of the things that's great about what the Victorians did, and particularly what Jon Snow did, the hero and one of the two heroes in my book, is that he was very kind of skilled at connecting the very small, the very local to the very large. So he was thinking about these invisible microorganisms that he believed were in the water that he tried to see but was never able to see but was looking for. But he was also thinking on the scale of the city itself and looking at broad patterns and kind of water consumption habits and lives and deaths and where people were falling ill and where they weren't. And that ability to move from the very local, the very intimate, to the kind of macro scale of a city or a planet is a skill we continue to need today to deal with the problems that we face in both developed and developing worlds.
You mentioned Jon Snow. He was one of the heroes of your book. Henry Whitehead, I presume you feel, was the other.
Yeah, and Whitehead has been largely ignored when this story has been told in the past. I mean, I think that's one of the things I tried to really contribute to the scholarship on this story, because he was in a sense the local vicar, basically, and he was one of those. He was not a man of science at all, but he was one of those classic kind of neighborhood characters who knows everyone, is a great kind of social connector, and was always over at his local parishioners having tea or hanging out in the local pub, drinking pints until late in the night. He was that kind of local vicar. And what he had was a great kind of social intelligence that complemented Snow's skills, which were not social in any way. He was much more of a kind of, you know, kind of scientific mind who did not have great social interactions with people. And when it came down to this quest to figure out what had caused this outbreak, Whitehead ended up kind of, for complicated reasons, getting involved in this investigation, and he ended up really being crucial to the investigation because he was able to track down particularly all the people who had fled once the cholera kind of flared up. There were a lot of people who just evacuated. And so Whitehead was able to track these people down and ended up actually finding the initial patient zero who had kind of started the whole outbreak in the first place. And without his kind of joint investigation alongside his new friend Jon Snow, the case might never really have been cracked in the way that it was. And so he was really crucial. And I think what he adds to the story, and in particularly in the issues that I'm concerned with in terms of urbanist issues, is that he was just this classic kind of amateur. He was a local expert who really knew what was going on in his community. And that's one of the great values of neighborhoods, is that they have these people that they're sharing their knowledge and connecting with other folks in the region.
Is there any way to cultivate these classic amateurs? Because, as you say, they do perform a very important social function, and yet they're uncompensated for it.
Yeah, I mean, what we have seen certainly in the last few years in a number of different areas, not just in terms of city neighborhoods, but across the board, is a huge, I wouldn't even say renaissance, I feel like naissance, of amateur expertise thanks to the web. I mean, Wikipedia is a fantastic example of just, you know, it is filled with all these, you know, entries written by people just for the love of it, which is the kind of etymological root of the word amateur, people who do things for the love of it, not for some professional compensation. You know, the blogosphere is filled with people like this as well. And so there's this great kind of rise of folks who do have these little kind of local bodies of knowledge that historically they've only been able to really share with their friends and family, and now they're actually able to share it with a much wider, in fact, a truly global audience. And what's cool about this, I think, for our purposes, is that we're seeing that happening with city neighborhoods. So the development of things like place bloggers who are writing blogs specifically about, you know, their local neighborhoods, and they're writing about the issues that actually are in some ways the most important issues to people who live in communities like that, where, you know, it's the troubled public school down the street, or that overpriced real estate offering, or, you know, the mugging that happened 3 weeks ago. You know, all those issues that, you know, that the people who live in neighborhoods are constantly talking about. Now, thanks to the web, that conversation can be a little bit louder, because you don't necessarily just have to have it kind of face to face at the coffee shop. You can put it online, and there can be 100 people involved in it, or 1,000 people involved in that conversation.
And you're trying to facilitate that conversation with the development of Outside In. Tell me about Outside In.
Yeah, Outside In was you know, this thing that we developed. It's just a classic, you know, Web 2.0 organization, where we put it together in 3 or 4 months with just 3 or 4 of us working on it part-time. But it came in a very real way out of the themes that I'd been kind of exploring in the Ghost Map. I basically started working on it right as I was finishing writing the book. So that was kind of a fun transition. And what we're trying to do is we're beginning with the assumption that there is a huge amount of information that's online that is relevant to people in terms of their local communities or other communities that they may be interested in, that they're visiting, or that they just want to keep track of. And some of that information is coming from these place bloggers who are writing about neighborhoods and sharing all their kind of local expertise. Some of it is coming from city sites, from services like Yelp and Backfence, that are other sites that are kind of asking people to review restaurants or write about the local PTA meeting. Some of it is coming from government sites, and some of it is coming from traditional media. You know, like when the New York Times reviews a restaurant down the street from me in Brooklyn, that's relevant to my neighborhood. The problem is there's no way to see all that information in one single spot. There's no way to kind of see all that information organized geographically. So what we've created is basically a system that lets you go in and say, okay, I'm sitting at this corner, or I'm in the neighborhood, say, Potrero Hill in San Francisco, or I'm thinking of visiting Cobble Hill in Brooklyn. And if you type those names or those addresses or zip codes in, you'll instantly see all the kind of conversations and recent information that showed up online about that particular space. And then you can apply different filters. So you can say, show me only crime stories that are about this particular neighborhood, or show me stories that have to do with poetry readings. And you can – one of the things that's fun about it is you can literally drag the map around. You can zoom in on the map, zoom out on the map, and instantly the information that you see will change. And to me, it lets you actually see the conversations that the actual kind of locals in these areas are having. It, you know, it's not just a travel guide kind of, you know, view of a place. I mean, it lets you gives you some of the nuance and texture of those conversations. So my favorite example of this is when I was on book tour a few weeks ago, I went to Denver, and we were about to launch Outside In at that point. And I'm in my hotel room, and I don't know Denver at all. And so I think to myself, oh, I wonder if we're actually covering Denver on Outside In yet. And so I type in the zip code that's on the hotel phone. I don't know what neighborhood I'm in Denver, except that I'm in somewhere in downtown Denver. And I see that, in fact, we are in Denver, and that there are you can see kind of top topics that people are talking about in that particular neighborhood. And I noticed that the number 3 topic is Daniel Libeskind, the architect. And so I think, well, that's weird. Why are they talking about that in Denver? And then I remember that, oh, they just opened a big museum that Libeskind designed. That's interesting. And so then I read about 4 or 5 posts from local bloggers writing about the museum, what people were saying, what the debate was. And I had this whole kind of amazing context for this museum. And then I opened the curtains in my hotel room, and there it was across the street.
That's amazing. Is the information for Outside In, and we should say outside.in, how does the original information get tagged so that it ends up in the right place at Outside In?
Yeah, it's a good question. We've tried to do it in a couple of different ways so that there's a lot of flexibility. The first thing we did was we identified about 600 place bloggers around the country in the top kind of 25 cities. And now we're in the top 50 cities. So the list of bloggers is actually longer than that. And basically every time, you know, one of those bloggers posts something new, we grab a little bit of the text and we tag it with a zip code or a specific address if they include that. And so that gets pulled into our database and is organized basically automatically. So it's, you know, it automatically fills up. Even if we, on day one, when we had nobody coming to the site, we still had a lot of content, particularly in some of the bigger cities. But we're actively trying to push people to contribute directly to the site. We've had about, I think, almost 2,000 submissions since we launched.
You were instrumental in feed plastic. So you've been trying to figure out the real power of the web for a long time. What should traditional media learn from outside in and other social networking tools that are evolving now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I feel like in some ways the debate about what these new web developments mean has been kind of warped by the way in which they were first adopted, some of these tools. So, you know, you think about the kind of amateurs versus experts debate that has come up a lot in talking about journalism, where, you know, kind of journalists are saying,
yes,
well, you know, these bloggers didn't go to journalism school and, you know, they're never going to be very good at covering the Iraq war. And so this whole thing is kind of overhyped in some ways. And to me, I look at that and I say, well, that's partially true. You know, I do think that, you know, credentialed journalists are going to be better with backed by newsrooms, are going to be better at going and covering the Iraq war than bloggers are. Bloggers may be just as good at doing commentary, but there's still a need for that kind of traditional journalism. But what's more interesting, I think, is the space where the bloggers and the other new forms of kind of community sites are doing something that traditional media just never did at all. So traditional media has always been very good at doing, you know, international news, national political news. But when you start getting down to that micro level of what's going on your block, or when are they going to put in that new stop sign that they've been promising to put on, those are questions that, you know, city papers have historically done a terrible job of covering. They can't deal with that kind of local scale. And so when the bloggers come along and start actually reporting on those issues, sharing, having the conversations about that, that's not doing battle with traditional media. It's actually opening up a whole new space that really never was covered before.
Let's talk a minute about the new column you're doing for the New York Times Select called Urban Planet. I love the name. In an early entry, you wrote about the political idea of red states, blue states, and you said that notion is all wrong. Why?
Well, because if you really look at the actual kind of breakdown, the useful organizing principle is not actually states when we think about it in terms of states, because that's how the Electoral College is organized. But in terms of where people are actually living, the big breakdown is really country versus city. So in this last election, actually, the way it broke down was in rural areas, the Republicans won not by a huge margin, but they won in, you know, kind of exurban and suburban areas, it was basically 50-50. And then in cities, the Democrats had 70% of the vote. So just overwhelmingly in cities. So the reason why there are kind of red states in the first place is because largely those are areas that their population base is not dominated by people who live in cities. What you can see is this kind of – there was a long-term strategy by the Republicans that might have made sense 30 years ago, in effect, to write off most of the cities in the country, because cities seem to be in kind of permanent decline in say, the mid-70s. And what's happened since then, in fact, is that there's been quite a remarkable transformation. A number of big cities are growing again. And the other thing that I think the Republicans didn't fully foresee was the kind of urbanization of the swing mountain states. So you see, you know, a city like kind of Boise becoming this little hotbed of kind of entrepreneurial Silicon Valley style tech development, and starting to become, thanks to that, more Democrat than you would have possibly imagined, 20 years ago.
And you make what I think are some very compelling points in that same entry about who pays for what and where real America is.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I don't want to sound like a kind of big city bigot or something like that there are beautiful parts of the country and wonderful people in rural areas and small towns. But there is an old, venerable, almost dating back to the beginning of the country in some ways, idea that real America lives in small towns and in the country, and that cities are somehow this fake part of America that somehow doesn't have American values. But in fact, you know, particularly in a country of immigrants, many of whom the number of people who whose ancestors spent some time in Brooklyn is an extraordinary number. I don't know what it is off the top of my head. And cities are huge wealth generators. I mean, we pay much more in taxes in big cities than we take in federal assistance, which is exactly the opposite of what most people think. Most people think of cities as, you know, where all the poverty is and the welfare queens and stuff like that. But in fact, cities, the main thing that cities have that demographically differentiates them from the rest of the country is that cities are where all the rich people are. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we pay a huge amount of taxes. And in fact, it's the largely rural red states that receive far more assistance from the government, contrary to all the kind of cliches. So what I was trying to say in the kind of second half of that column is to say not that, you know, it can all be real America, but we need to get rid of this idea that there's something kind of inauthentic or parasitic about cities in terms of American culture. We're in many ways the kind of the center of American culture.
I want to circle back to the book, The Ghost Map. You say that it's a story of the power of dense cities to create solutions to problems that they themselves have brought about. What is it you think, Stephen, about the power of dense cities that give them that power?
Well, in the case of the Ghost Map, it's an interesting one where what actually happened is you cram all these people together. It creates an environment where disease can thrive because people are basically living on top of each other and they don't have the proper waste management techniques to deal with this. So water gets contaminated and you start getting these outbreaks. But the outbreaks, because everyone is so kind of closely packed together, the outbreak ends up kind of revealing this pattern. And that's the pattern that you see in this map that Jon Snow created that shows the deaths basically in the neighborhood radiating out from this central pump that had gotten contaminated. And that map became central to convincing people that the cholera was in fact a problem of the water and not, in fact, as many people believed, a problem with the air. And so it was the density of people there, literally the density of people dying around this contaminated pump that made it possible to kind of see the cholera in a way. You couldn't see it under a microscope, but you could kind of see it reflected in this pattern. And there are a whole host of other things like that happen in kind of dense urban areas where you get people together, you see kind of patterns in what they're doing. Those patterns can reveal certain ways of kind of solving problems, and it's the congregation of people that makes that possible in the first place.
Stephen, it was fun to talk to you. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure.
Stephen Johnson is author of The Ghost Map. After a short break, we'll talk with Jackie Grimshaw about solving mysteries in today's cities, and we'll talk to Otis White about water, not in 1854 London, but in New York today. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, conservation and climate control are on everyone's minds these days, and it turns out that you've found a city that's actually done something about it.
Yeah, you know, we think of government as being so helpless. We forget the awesome power that governments can bring to bear. And in this one, you can almost reduce to a formula, and that is big changes equals small moves over a large population base plus time. And in this case, it's New York City, and it has reduced the amount of water it consumes over the past quarter century, 25 years, by 28%, even as its population grew by more than a million and a record number of visitors came to the city. Now, to put this into context, New York City now uses less water than any time since the early 1950s. So, the obvious question is, how did it bring off this incredible feat? And the answer is that when it got serious about water conservation in the 1980s, it really implemented two strategies that have just worked wonders. The first one is, and this will seem incredible to people outside of New York, it began metering the water usage of its residents. Now, I know this will sound astonishing, but up until the 1980s, New York did not use meters on its water deliveries to residential users. It simply counted the street frontage, the number of feet along the front of the building and the sides of the building, and the number of faucets or toilets in the building. It didn't actually try to measure how many gallons were being used, so there was obviously no personal conservation reward for residents. The second thing, and probably the more powerful thing it did, was it passed an ordinance saying that all new construction and renovation projects must install these water savings devices, low-flow toilets and shower heads and all the things that people hate. The good news is that while we may dislike these things, they really, really do work. And over the past quarter century, it has made tremendous differences. The sort of final element, if there's a third element here, it is that the technology of water conservation has truly improved. Public restrooms now have these faucets that automatically shut off, and washing machines use a lot less water. So you put all these little things together over time with a large population base, and you get what looks like miracles.
There's hope.
Yeah, there is hope. We can do it.
It's actually good news. Otis, thanks so much.
You bet.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. Jackie Grimshaw works with the Center for Neighborhood Technology in Chicago, where she directs the center's transportation and air quality programs and is responsible for the center's research efforts, computer modeling programs, and community development activities. She has extensive experience developing consensus in support of less polluting transportation options and initiating programs that assist the revitalization of inner-city neighborhoods. Jackie previously served as the Deputy Director for Economic Development for the City of Chicago, and she's a member of the President's Council for Sustainable Development and the Advisory Board of the Surface Transportation Policy Project. Jackie, tell me about the work of the Center for Neighborhood Technology.
The Center for Neighborhood Technology is almost 30 years old. It was founded in 1978, and our mission is really to be an innovation lab for urban sustainability. And we work in the areas of energy, transportation, community development, natural resources, all towards creating opportunities for people to have more sustainable opportunities and to impact household budgets so that people can afford to live in urban environments.
In 1978, that's a long time ago when it comes to talking about sustainability. I'm just curious about the founding. What was the impulse, do you know?
Well, CNT has always, we have been kind of an avant-garde organization. You know, we have created a lot of terms, I think, over our almost 30-year history. CNT actually came out of a project that our founder, Scott Bernstein, did when he was a student at Northwestern University. The Center for Urban Affairs placed students in urban areas to work with community-based organizations on identifying and solving problems. And Scott was assigned to the Christian Action Ministry, and they were concerned about what was happening with the number of admissions to Cook County Hospital. So the students, of which Scott was a part, set out to figure out why emergency admissions were going on at County Hospital, and then to try and find solutions. And what they discovered, the three highest incidents that would cause people to go into the emergency room were rat bites, vitamin deficiency, and people who were the victim of car crashes. So they looked at to try and find out why these things were happening. Well, on the Congress, the Eisenhower Expressway, Interstate 290, it would get congested. People would leave the interstate, try and go on the frontage roads, the arterials along the interstate. There was bad lighting. There was potholes, car, people crashes happening. People would end up in the hospital as a result. The rat bites came about because people had dogs. People couldn't afford to keep them. They would let them, you know, loose, and the dogs would run wild. They formed packs. In order to survive, they would go into the garbage cans in the alleys. They'd knock them over, you know, they'd find whatever food. We, you know, of course, dogs don't pick up after themselves, so the trash was in the alley, and rats had themselves a smorgasbord of edible delights, and the rat population grew. The reason for the vitamin deficiencies turned out to be that when they looked at the community, there were no places in the community to get fresh fruits and vegetables. So people were, you know, living on, you know, canned foods and, you know, dried foods and things of that sort. So then, you know, having identified the problem, the question is, what's the solution? So in each case, it was innovative solutions for the dogs running wild and the rats. They got a pool of money, and they told the kids in the neighborhood if they found or spotted a pack of dogs, if they called animal control, they would get a $5 bounty for each dog that was collected.
Oh.
Well, needless to say, it didn't take very long for all the dogs to be identified and off the streets. And then they worked with the city to bait the alleys, secure the garbage cans. So they got, you know, new garbage cans with lids on them in the community. And with the baiting of the alleys, you know, the rat population got under control. With the crashes and, you know, people, car crashes, again, it was advocating with the city to improve the street lighting and fix the potholes. And, I mean, I make this sound very, you know, like matter-of-fact, but it took a lot of effort on the part of the community groups to make this happen, to get the city to recognize the problem and to come up with the solution. With the vitamin deficiency, the creation of community gardens, now this is back in... Yeah, this was actually pre-'78. That's why Scott was still a student. They got community gardens going on the west side of Chicago. So, yeah, that's a long way of explaining how we got started and the innovations that created the center. And so after the center got started, you know, this process of trying to find, identify problems and trying to find solutions that were affordable solutions so that this was something that could easily be replicated in other places, it has become, you know, the way we do work at the center.
One of your basic beliefs is that cities are not bundles of problems and deficits, but rather they are collections of hidden assets. What are some of those hidden assets?
Well, over on the west side, for example,
the west side of Chicago.
One of the first projects I did when I got to the Center for Neighborhood Technology was to work with a coalition of groups that range from Oak Park River Forest all the way through the west side and to downtown. And that was around the issue of the CTA's decision to close the what was then called the Lake Street Line. Well, this group had organized because, you know, the CTA looked at, you know, this line. In fact, they had engineering studies done that said, you know, there were serious structural problems with that line, that, you know, the trains had to go in some cases, you know, more than 5 miles an hour because, you know, the vibration could bring the structure down. So, you know, this had been a line that had been actually transit around the country had been disinvested in as we got into the era of the interstate highway system, and all transportation funds just about were going to highways and not to transit. So, you know, from the CTA's point of view and the engineering analysis, that this was a line that needed a lot of money in order to bring it up to standards, or it should be taken down. And so, you know, the easy thing to do is to take it down. Well, the community saw this as, you know, their access, even if it was going 5 miles an hour, their access to where they needed to go, either downtown or to shopping, to jobs, to school, or to the western suburbs, which was also, you know, part of the retail and commercial base for people who lived on the west side. The merchants, of course, in Oak Park and River Forest saw this as a threat to their customers, you know, that the customers couldn't get to them, that would affect their market share. So, you know, this coalition was busy saying no to the CTA, but, you know, they clearly understood that just saying no was not going to achieve the objectives, and so they asked the center to provide some technical assistance to them to come up with the solutions that would get the CTA to say, yes, let's repair the line instead of tearing it down.
Let's talk about sustainability a minute. We've had a number of conversations on Smart City about the idea, the notion of cities being a solution to the sustainability problems, particularly the environmental sustainability problems that the world faces. But let's talk about the U.S. and U.S. cities. Do you see cities as that kind of asset? And how would you, you know, how would you assess cities in terms of their ability to be solutions for the environmental challenges we face?
Well, the way I think I would answer that, and this is another term that came out of the work of the Center for Neighborhood Technology, and that's the notion of location efficiency. And I would say that cities are efficient places to be. And in cities, we are able to have the kind of density that makes commerce work. We have densities that allow transit to work. We have opportunities for people to have a variety of living styles, to use less energy. So, you know, everything that you look at about cities, you look at it in terms of the efficiency of how cities operate. And in terms of environment, you know, we did an analysis, because in the Chicago area, we are a non-attainment area for ozone. And so we did a research analysis in terms of where the ozone was coming from. You know, what's the source of the ozone? If you look at the Chicago area, it looks like the city of Chicago is a source of a high level of ozone. But if you look at the origin of that, you see that the volatile organic compounds that make up ozone come from tailpipe emissions, and where you see the tailpipe emissions at their highest are in suburban areas, not in the city. And so the map of ozone is a high concentration of ozone coming from suburban areas, but because of the way, you know, air moves and vectors of air and so forth, it ends up over the city of Chicago, but the city of Chicago is not the major pollutant. And so, you know, that's another way of looking at if we want to have a sustainable environment, then we need to provide some transportation options for people who live in suburban areas, that we need to we need to retrofit suburban areas so that they can be more efficient and can be more like cities and have options so that they can pollute less. And so that's, you know, one of the things in terms of our community development efforts that we are trying to do. We're working right now in two suburbs, Harvey and Blue Island, around the issue of, you know, these are, again, communities with an awful lot of assets, but have been disinvested in for a variety of reasons. And so instead of going out and trying to develop communities in a green field, why don't we reinvest in communities that are already have the infrastructure, they have a whole number of assets, and can be options for people to live locally so that they don't have to rely on transportation for their daily lives.
Now, you mentioned mapping the ozone and its source. You've actually mapped the green infrastructure of the region around Chicago. What did the maps tell you?
Well, this is a project, you know, the Center for Neighborhood Technology also, you know, we do a lot of our own research, but we also partner with other organizations. And with the Open Lands project here in Chicago, we were interested in looking at what are some of the natural resources in terms of water, in terms of land area, in terms of, you know, the streams, you know, that contribute to, you know, our water system. What kind of infrastructure existed, you know, along the Lake Michigan Basin, starting in Wisconsin, you know, coming into Illinois and going around to Indiana. Also, you know, what were the development patterns along those rivers and streams and wetlands in the region? And so we got information from Wisconsin, you know, Department of Natural Resources, from Illinois Department of Natural Resources, and Indiana, and got, as well as getting information from the counties and the cities, as much information we could get to build data layers that allowed us to map the green infrastructure along the Lake Michigan Basin from Wisconsin around to Indiana.
And once you mapped all of that, were you able to draw new insights from that work that said we need to be behaving differently, or we need to move this up on the list of priorities?
Well, you know, the reason why we did this was to make this information available to everybody. You know, you go on our website, you can see it, you go to Open Lands, you know, we have maps, hard maps that we can give you, you can download the information. But it really was a tool for everyone to use. Now, in terms of our own work and looking at this green infrastructure, it caused us to say, how can communities make better decisions around how to preserve the natural resources that we have? And that led us to create a green infrastructure calculator so that communities, the public policy decision makers, et cetera, could decide on what kind of infrastructure they wanted to deal with water. So right now there is the building standard is that you put gutters around houses, you put downspouts from those gutters into the ground, that these downspouts are then connected to the sewer. So when it rains, you know, the water goes in the gutter, in the downspout, into the sewers. And, you know, if there's too much water, then we get flooded basements. And so, you know, that's one way of dealing with stormwater. The other thing to do is that we can let that water infiltrate into the ground so that we can recharge our aquifers, that we can, you know, replenish or actually filter the water that goes back into streams and other kinds of tributaries or wetlands or whatever. And so, you know, what's the cost of doing sewer or letting that water go into a rain garden and infiltrate into the ground so that you can actually do that calculation so you can see which is the more economic way of dealing with stormwater. And so, you know, what we tried to do was to take this information on natural resources and turn it again into something that could be translated into how to impact community budgets, municipal budgets, as well as household budgets.
I want to get back to the issue of transit. You've been looking recently at the potential for redevelopment of parking lots near rail transit stations in Cook County, Chicago's location. Tell me why you focused on that topic and what you found.
Well, again, it's looking at assets. And, you know, there was this research on parking lots came from other research that we were doing. And the predecessor to the parking lot work was that there is demand for housing near transit. And there is a demand for a variety of price points for housing around transit. Also, the fact that we had a number of train stations that were underdeveloped, that, you know, are assets that are sitting in communities that essentially was not contributing to the tax base of that city by having productive work. It was sitting there as, you know, parking lots that were paved over, that was contributing to, you know, this heat island because we had all of this asphalt that was not contributing to water infiltration in the ground because they were impermeable pavement that was sitting in these parking lots. So, you know, this whole constellation of issues, problems, and opportunities looking at transit stations and what was being done with the land around the transit station. So, you know, we said, okay, all right, if people want housing around transit, you have these parking lots that are sitting around transit. Why don't we take these parking lots and turn them into developments where you could have residents, that you could have retail businesses, and so forth? So we set about looking at Cook County and all three areas of Cook County, the north, the west, and the south, to see if we could identify opportunities for creating this economic opportunity. But more than that, is to make the argument that it is beneficial to communities as well as to individual households to have transit-oriented development. So, you know, we looked at communities where they had, in fact, created transit-oriented developments. We looked at those communities that had just parking lots at those train stations, and we looked at communities that were, as we like to say, adult development that was adjacent to the transit station. So we did case studies of these three different types of areas in the north, in the west, and the south, and did an economic analysis of what kind of a contribution in terms of taxes would be available or what was being lost by having a parking lot versus turning those parking lots into development. You know, the methodology we used was the same methodology just about that, you know, commercial real estate agents look at in terms of deciding, or developers look at in terms of deciding, you know, what makes economic sense. So, you know, I think our methodology was sound in how we looked at parking lot opportunities for transit-oriented development.
And what did you find?
That communities would be much better off developing those parking lots than letting them sit there contributing to global warming rather than to the economic betterment of the municipalities.
Do you risk making transit less convenient to those who have to drive to the transit station? I mean, they obviously want to park conveniently close to the, as close as possible to the station.
Yeah, well, you know, if they didn't park so close to the station, they get a little bit more exercise, and we probably would deal with the obesity problem as well. But, no, I mean, the thing is that we say that, you know, we don't eliminate the parking, is that the parking should be incorporated into the economic redevelopment. So, you know, if you look at a place like Arlington Heights, several years ago, did the very same thing. I mean, on their own, looking at, you know, the opportunities that existed to have residents as well as economic development around the parking around its the train station. You know, they created structured parking that can have multi uses. It can be used by the commuters who have to drive to the station, as well as, you know, on the weekends it is a parking lot for people who are using the retail businesses, so that, you know, you have a parking lot that's incorporated into the transit oriented development rather than being, you know, the only thing that is at the train station.
Just one more question, Jackie. What do you think it will take to make Americans serious about public transit in sufficient numbers to make good transit a reality?
People need to experience it. You know, you look at every place in the country where they have new transit lines going in. In a lot of cases, you know, it's replacing the transit lines that used to be there before we got into this automobile craze, right? But, you know, whether or not it's Dallas or Minneapolis, or Portland, every single one of these new lines have exceeded the market analysis of what the ridership would be on the first day. And, you know, it's an indication that if people have the option, they will use it. And so we have to provide the options. And transit has to be convenient, and it has to be reliable, in some cases even redundant. So unless we make transit ubiquitous almost, but unless you have that kind of service, you know, people are going to, you know, not look at transit as a real option for them in terms of getting around.
Jackie, it was fun talking with you. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, my pleasure, Carol. Anytime.
Jackie Grimshaw directs the Center for Neighborhood Technologies, Transportation, and Air Quality Programs. It was more than 30 years ago when George Carlin's monologue, Seven Words You Can Never Say on Television, first appeared on his album Class Clown. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith examines the use of swear words today.
Hardly a day goes by that we don't hear somebody swearing about something in public. We're awash in a sea of profanity. Every little annoyance or triumph seems to warrant an expletive. Vulgarity has become the vernacular of popular culture, from movies to music to radio shock jocks to cable TV to the internet. Timothy Jay, a professor of psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, has studied swearing, and he says that public swearing is on the rise. He estimates that swear words now comprise 10% of the average adult's work vocabulary and 13% away from work. Women are cursing more in public, and kids are cursing more in school and at younger ages than ever before. Not to mention that the curse words we use nowadays are worse than ever before. Much of what was once offensive is now so commonplace that it no longer gives offense. Paralleling the rise in profanity is a widespread disengagement from one another and a decline in a shared sense of respect and support for public places. We find ourselves more and more estranged from public spaces in which we feel the obligation to exercise restraint and civility. Our uncompromising language distances ourselves from others. By its very nature, cursing is antagonistic, even when used in jest. Professor Jay suggests that cursing evolved as a nonviolent way of displaying aggression and as a shorthand for expressing emotions. In these ways, cursing may actually help to build a sense of community because it displaces destructive behavior and purges damaging emotions. But what do we make of the cursing we encounter today? Something that has become much more than just the occasional cleansing outburst. The Center for Media and Public Affairs confirms through its research that vulgarity is no longer used only in hostility, but as an everyday part of life. The ubiquity of cursing is symptomatic of a lost sense of common space. There is no place left that is important enough to us that we will unfailingly treat it with the highest degree of respect, restraint, and courtesy. We don't feel connected with others when we are out in public, hence we speak to them without the common courtesies that are the foundation of community. We have lost any feeling of responsibility to cherish and cultivate a welcoming community atmosphere in a common public space, and so our cursing goes unchecked. When I was growing up, my mother refused to let me and my sisters say the word stupid. It was a curse word to her. Not because it was a vulgarity per se, but because she believed that calling someone stupid was rude, disrespectful, and just as antagonistic as cursing. Preserving the sense of connectedness and common space was more important to her than calling somebody a name that he or she might deserve. My mother taught me that ugly words come in all varieties, and that much of the time, building community is no more complicated than simply holding one's tongue. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders serving as an idea lab for cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.